From the Center for God and Culture and the studios of Faith Talk 1500, welcome to the Paul Edwards Program. Information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here now is Paul Edwards.
The sad news of the day is that J.D. Salinger has evidently died yesterday. And just now learning that J.D. Salinger, who much more of a recluse, I think, than Howard Hughes ever was, disappeared from public life after the publication of Catcher in the Rye, that story of American teenage angst. J.D. Salinger dead today at the age of 91. Welcome into the Paul Edwards Program. All across southeastern Michigan, northwest Ohio, and parts of Ontario, Canada, here in the Center for the Study of God and Culture. A little later this hour, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Mark Atkinson and his wife, Carol. I've known them for years. Matter of fact, I was the best man in Mark's wedding. I guess I was the best man in Carol's wedding, too, since she's married to him. And they're going to join me. They live now in Florida, and they've just returned from Haiti, where they spent several days on a medical mission there and have some very moving stories to tell, and very anxious to share those stories with you here on the program. Also, many in this audience probably have a connection of some sort to Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. Wheaton, of course, has been described as the Harvard of evangelicalism. The New York Times recently described Wheaton as the Vatican of evangelicalism. They are in the process of seeking a new president. Dwayne Litfin, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, has been there for 17 years and has retired. He's still there until they find a successor. But there's an interesting piece in SOMA, the Society of Mutual Autopsy, which I think is tongue-in-cheek. Wither Wheaton is the philosopher Andrew, and I hope I'm pronouncing Andrew's name right, Chignell, Scottish. He's going to join me to talk about where Wheaton is headed. He's a Wheaton grad. And is Wheaton going the way of most educational institutions that started with the conservative Christian foundation? Are they moving away from that? We'll explore that a little bit later here on the program as well. And Congressman Pete Hoekstra going to join us next hour to run down the State of the Union address. So we got as well. The New York Times, never shy about taking a headline that has nothing to do with the facts. After long decline, teenage pregnancy rate rises. Now, that headline is certainly true. You add to that the headline from Health Leaders Media from January 20th, Abstinence Education, a controversial piece of health reform. The World Today with Eleanor Hall, all these headlines. U.S. teen pregnancy rise blamed on abstinence programs. All of this based mainly on the Alan Guttmacher Institute's recent study that shows beginning in about 2006-2007, there was like a 1% rise in the incidences of pregnancy among teenage girls ages 15 to 19. And as has been said, abstinence-based education is being blamed for this. The National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy is quoted in the New York Times piece, quote Sarah Brown, "It's very disturbing. We had over a decade of progress on a very serious problem, and I worry that we've ground to a halt. I think there are a lot of different factors at play, from less use of contraception, maybe because of less fear of AIDS, to our anything-goes culture, where it's okay to get pregnant and have a baby in your teens." But the New York Times opens the piece by saying, after more than a decade of declining teenage pregnancy, the pregnancy rate among girls ages 15 to 19 increased 3% from 2005 to 2006, a turnaround likely to intensify the debate over federal financing of abstinence-only sex education. The teenage abortion rate also crept up for the first time in more than a decade, rising 1% from 2005 to 2006. According to an analysis, are you ready for this, by the Guttmacher Institute, a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group. I would take issue with that description. Valerie Huber is executive director of the National Abstinence Education Association. And Valerie, I'm glad that you're able to make some time for us here in Detroit. How are you?
I'm doing well, and thank you for having me.
What do you make of the Guttmacher study? Do you think, number one, that it's that it's a study that we can trust, given the fact that I think you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I certainly don't think they're a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group.
Well, they're certainly not a nonpartisan research group. As you know, the Guttmacher Institute had its beginnings from Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. named after one of the presidents of Planned Parenthood. I think that the data that they're sharing is accurate. I think their analysis rings hollow. For them to ascribe 100% of the problem of an increase in teen pregnancy to an approach that only receives 25% of the funding for sex education, it's just disingenuous. And you probably, if you read the New York Times article, you probably saw my quote in there, in which I stated that, you know, this is a very complex problem, and I don't think any of us can narrowly say that it's as a result of just one thing. The kids are living in a super sexualized culture, and parents are reticent to talk to their children about this issue, when in fact they should be guiding them much more directly than they are. And then if you add on to that the fact that 75% of the sex education across the country is actually giving the green light to sexual experimentation, you know, it doesn't come as that much of a surprise, although it is disconcerting.
What consists of abstinence education? When we talk about abstinence-only education, is it really abstinence-only, or when we talk about a public school setting in particular, is comprehensive sex education also being mingled in with it, even though it's called abstinence-only?
Well, we actually don't like the term abstinence only, because that was a term created by those who oppose us to make it sound like it's a very narrow just say no message. If the truth be told, abstinence education is actually much more comprehensive than so-called comprehensive sex education. Your assertion that perhaps abstinence education and contraceptive education are often mingled within the same schools is entirely accurate. We see that happen very often. But among those schools that teach abstinence-centered education alone, those students are receiving so much good information, but on top of information, they're receiving the skills, motivation, and encouragement to make the healthiest choices, and they're given the tools in order to succeed in that.
Why is it you think that that Guttmacher and the New York Times and the media? I mean, the simple answer to the question I'm about to ask you is, well, they're liberal and they've got an agenda. But why is it that as you've said, 75% of the sex ed in the school systems today is not abstinence based education? So why make abstinence education the scapegoat for this report that indicates a 3% rise in teen pregnancy?
Well, it's a very interesting question, particularly since this information was released first about a year ago. So why is it new news now? It was the front page of USA Today the day before, and it was in Wall Street Journal and on virtually every news network across the country. The answer is pretty simple. President Obama zeroed out abstinence education funding in his 2010 budget, and those who oppose this approach rejoiced. However, near the end of this year, we were successful in seeing an amendment go through the Senate, and it reached bipartisan support that would reinstate a state block grant for abstinence education. Now, it still hasn't passed the House, but they are so upset that even one penny that's devoted to sex education would go to abstinence education, that we believe that this is a part of a concerted effort to try to squash the success of those efforts in Congress.
The New York Times points out that Bill Clinton actually advocated for abstinence education for, I guess, the welfare program that he overhauled. Are they being accurate about President Clinton's support for abstinence? Would President Clinton have supported abstinence the way you and I are supporting abstinence?
Well, as surprising as it may seem to you, nationwide funding for abstinence education did indeed begin with President Clinton. And it wasn't until President Bush came along that it got an increase, but the first major funding for abstinence education, as you and I would define it, indeed started under President Clinton. And it's that funding that is seeking to be reestablished with the Senate amendment that we were successful in, and indeed that the New York Times is relating that the Guttmacher Institute wants to see end.
What would happen, Valerie, to abstinence education in schools if federal funding disappeared? I think currently it's set to expire this summer, June or July. And what happens if that funding goes away? And shouldn't we be seeking alternative funding, maybe leave the federal government out of it altogether and look for more local revenue to fund it?
Well, you bring up a very good point. We just concluded our national conference for NAEA, and abstinence programs from across the country assembled, and we asked that very question. When abstinence education funding ends, and it actually expires the end of September, what are you going to do? Are you going to be going out of business? Are you going to be reducing your service to students, or will you remain the same? And most will be having to reduce their service as a result, and some will be going out of business unless they can find some alternatives. This is a community problem, and I think that there needs to be an understanding at the local level that we need to promote the best health message among young people. So we really do hope that we can be creative and continue these programs using non-governmental funding, which I agree, that's the best way to do it if we can.
The core message of abstinence education is, I mean, it may be broader than this, and I don't want to be too sophomoric here, but if we could grind it down to a simple sentence, are we asking these teenagers to wait until marriage? I mean, is it that defined where the abstinence programs we're talking about, Valerie, are saying, look, you're going to be better off if you get into a committed marriage relationship with a person for life before you engage in sex? Or is it something other than that? Is it a message about simply waiting?
Yes and no. The explicit message really is the social science research is overwhelmingly in favor of the statement you just made, and that is children flourish when they are born within a committed marriage relationship. And so whenever you have sexual activity, there's always that possibility that you're going to bring another child into the world. And so if we really want to give them the best nest for flourishing, we need to wait until marriage. But you know, marriage is a long way off for a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old who's in an abstinence class. And so the practical working out of that message is you need to finish high school and set your goals. You need to avoid situations that make it a temptation to engage in sexual activity. And we recognize that the longer a young person waits to have sex, the better off they're going to be. We hope every one of them waits until marriage. But the reality is some won't, many won't, but there's still value in the message that they need to wait as long as they can. We hope that they catch the vision for that next generation that they will bring into the world and wait until marriage.
The reason I bring that up is I can't remember in all of the reams of stories that I've read on this topic, Valerie, someone pointed out, and I think it was somebody on the opposing side, pointed out that the majority of the increase in teen pregnancy between 15 and 19-year-olds were in the 18 and 19 age category. And their argument was, it does appear that abstinence-based education works to prolong the onset of when maybe these kids start having a sexual relationship. But and they may wait until they get out of high school. But it seems like as soon as they graduate from high school at age 18 and 19, they're engaging in sex. Do you have a comment about whether or not that is in fact true, that abstinence education may be just encouraging these kids not to have sex while in high school, but the moment they graduate, they think, oh, I'm an adult and I can do what I want?
Well, you know, no one knows exactly why that phenomena happens. Part of it could be that they're no longer receiving the reinforcement that they received in their abstinence classes to remain abstinent. You know, with any kind of risk behavior, it's very important that there be ongoing reinforcement of those healthy messages, whether it's in the home or somewhere else. If that ends and all they receive is the messaging that's in the broad culture that makes sex expected and without consequences, then, you know, there's no pushback. But I think that we lose sight of another important set of data, which shows that the longer a person waits to become sexually active, just from a practical and health standpoint, the fewer lifetime partners they have, and that translates into less of a risk for acquiring STDs or passing them on to others or for having a child outside of marriage. Of course, we want them to wait until marriage, but we know the data shows that many won't. That does not invalidate the abstinence message. And just to further illustrate that, if you look at any other kind of public health messaging, let's take exercise and nutritious eating, for example. As America gets heavier and exercises less, do we find that the public health messaging then retreats from encouraging healthy eating and exercise? No, it increases right. In order to try to change that social health norm. Well, the very same thing should be the case in the area of sexual activity before marriage. It should be of great concern that we see an increase among 18, 19-year-olds, and actually 20 to 24-year-olds are even worse. Instead of retreating and saying, this is a worthless approach, we know it is not a worthless approach, and we also know that it's the healthiest goal. So we should find ways to strengthen that message and increase giving that and helping young people and young adults stick to that or reclaim it rather than abandoning it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? At the same time that the public education is taking, you know, candy machines and soda pop machines out of schools for the physical health of the children in those schools, they are at the same time encouraging and assuming that these kids are not going to guard their sexual health because they're offering them condoms and basically saying, we know you're going to do this. It's interesting to me, Valerie, that these educators don't have the same attitude toward the sexuality of kids as they do the obesity of kids.
Absolutely. It's a conflict of priorities, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Valerie Huber is the executive director of the National Abstinence Education Association. So when you're seeing all of these reports blaming abstinence education for the rise in teen pregnancy, get the facts at www.abstinenceassociation.org. Valerie, I appreciate so much you giving us some time and giving us some insight.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
19 minutes after the hour. When we continue, we're going to go to Haiti via my friends Mark and Carol Atkinson. Dr. Mark Atkinson has just returned. He and his wife both just returned from Haiti on a medical missions trip. It's not the first trip that they've made. It's something that's been close to their heart for a very long time. And they're going to share some of their stories with us from the trip they've just returned from this week when the Paul Edwards program continues here on Faith Talk 1500.
If you owe more than $20,000 in back taxes, now that it's 2010, the door is closing on the best shot in 50 years to settle your tax debt for less. Hi, this is Rich Boggs, founder and CEO of Nationwide Tax Relief. Breaking news, the 2009 IRS leniency program has been extended for the time being, but it will end, and it has been a game changer for so many of our clients. If you're suffering with wage garnishments, bank levies, an audit, or unfiled tax returns, my team of tax professionals and expert attorneys can step in, step up, and settle your tax debt. Make 2010 a happy new year and take advantage of this official leniency before it's gone.
Call 800-690-8330. If you owe between $20,000 and $2 million in any IRS or state back taxes, your consultation is free. Call Nationwide Tax Relief at 800-690-8330. That's 800-690-8330. Call 800-690-8330 now.
Well, it's the new year. Time for the resolutions again. New self-imposed disciplines and commitments in your life. You know, you're really going to get it together. Your physical health, home, spiritual life, budget. Give it 110%. But don't forget your vehicles. You know, the thing that gives you your freedom. The means to get everywhere. To work, school, church, and stores. May the good people at Master Auto recommend that you take a new approach to vehicle repair, maintenance, so you can avoid unwarranted major repairs. Maintenance such as coolant and transmission flushes, power steering, axle and brake fluid changes, alignments, tire rotations, and tune-ups. They aren't just recommendations, but required for long vehicle life and will help you save money over the long term. Let Master Auto at 7 Mile in Inkster and Redford help you maintain your vehicles. Call Master Auto at 313-532-2500. That's Master Auto, 7 Mile in Inkster in Redford, 313-532-2500.
1,500 pastors leave the ministry every month, never to return. 70% of pastors fight depression. All pastors and their spouses need support, and the Evangelical Pastors Network is here to help. The Evangelical Pastors Network is a new local organization by pastors for pastors. We at Faith Talk 1500 and Detroit Rescue Mission Ministries are excited to partner with EPN for their inaugural dinner on Monday, February 1st at the San Marino Club in Troy, with special guest speaker H.B. London, who heads pastoral ministry for Focus on the Family. Simply visit evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com and register today. The cost is only $20 for your spouse and you, or $10 for individuals. Register today, visit evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com or call 248-627-2513. That's evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com or call 248-627-2513.
You know, when a devastating act of God, can I say, like a hurricane or an earthquake happens, you know, the immediate reaction around those events is always an outpouring of help and prayer. And, you know, now we're going on nearly 3 weeks since the earthquake that devastated Haiti. And the farther removed we get from those events, the more likely it is that we will become numb to them. And I want to keep this fresh in your minds, and I want to remind you that our friends at Food for the Poor are still accepting your donations as they work on the ground to get relief supplies to those who are hurting there in Haiti. And you can make a gift of any amount simply by calling them toll-free at 866-433-HOPE, 866-433-4673. Someone that knows firsthand about what's going on in Haiti, and not just simply because they have been in Haiti most recently in the aftermath of the earthquake, but this has been something that's been a part of their ministry together for several years, is my high school friend, who is now the American Diabetes Association eminent scholar in the University of Florida's Department of Pathology, Immunology, and Laboratory Medicine, Dr. Mark Atkinson. And Mark, that's too much for me to I just know you as Mark.
And that's the way I want you to keep calling me, Paul, just Mark.
How are you?
Joyful to be home, but also here with a great degree of sadness. When you experience what we did this past week, you leave a bit of your heart in Haiti. And people today have been asking me that around me, what are my thoughts? And I have been saying, I can't wait to get back.
You were actually in Haiti at the end of December, the first week in January, obviously, before any of us knew about what was about to happen in Haiti. I think you returned on like January 5th in that neighborhood, and then January 12th is when the earthquake hit. You and Carol have been involved with Haiti way long before this earthquake. Tell us about your personal experience with Haiti prior to these events.
Right. Well, it's kind of an interesting thing where how God will put you in positions. I guess the world will call it serendipity, I think, with a spiritual outlook, you'd say it was God's providence. And I, back in the 90s, our pastor asked me to fill in for lunch for him because he had at the last minute. And I thought, okay, free lunch. And I went in and met a missionary from a group located in Ohio, or headquartered in Ohio, called Mission Possible. And at that meeting, I just became intrigued at Haiti and the opportunities there for missions. Carol and I took a scout trip down there, and we just could not believe what we saw. It was like going back in time in a way, or opening up the pages of National Geographic, even though it was only a little over an hour's plane ride from Miami. And it changed our lives, and we've been back yearly, almost yearly since, leading medical and dental and evangelistic teams of about 20 to 40 each time.
Is it all medical professionals that are going on these trips?
No. I say thankfully no, because if you go and everybody's just a doctor, it doesn't work. And one of the things we learned early on is that just like with the spiritual applications with one body, but people with many different giftings, we found that it works best if you bring people of a variety of different talents and means to come to the table. So we bring doctors, nurses, physical therapists often on our teams. We have dentists sometimes. And then we also have very motivated lay people who just have a sincere heart for missions, because done right, again, you find out what everybody's talents are and just work together for a common cause and purpose.
The realities on the ground there prior to the earthquake, I mean, you've been going down there for decades, I guess. 15, 16 years you've been going?
Exactly. And it's, the facts and the figures are out there about, and some of the facts and figures, as if you've been watching the news, and Carol and I have spent more days in the last month in Haiti than we have here, so I'm not exactly sure all the news that's being reported. But again, I can tell you that, again, the average income, again, per family ranges, I've seen estimates from $400 to $1,000 per family. About, 50 to 80% of the people are functionally illiterate. The unemployment rate, again, who knows what it is, but it's commonly quoted as 80 to 84%. I believe it's estimated that between 1 in 5 and 1 in 8 children die by the age of 8. 1 in 12 to 20 and 20 adults are affected with HIV. It's just that you hear statistics all the time, but these are the ones that you don't want to hear. And then when you see them firsthand, it's impacting.
You know, Mark, you are the American Diabetes Association eminent scholar. I mean, that's a heavy duty title in at the University of Florida, and yet there are pictures of your last trip on Carol's Facebook that I looked at. You're sleeping on a tarmac at the Port-au-Prince Airport, I think. What would make somebody of your stature stoop so low?
It seems to me, I remember reading somewhere in the Bible about that Christ challenged us to do whatever we could for the least of these. And, it's just like he would take the low seat and wash the people's feet. I don't know. As I get on in my life and in Carolyn's life, we find ourselves trying to more and more decrease so that he can increase in the work of others. And I sincerely mean that.
Yeah, I know you do. My guest is my friend, Dr. Mark Atkinson, who, as I just stated, is American Diabetes Association eminent scholar in the University of Florida's Department of Pathology, Immunology, and Laboratory Medicine. He and his wife have just returned from Haiti on a medical missions trip. Where were you when you heard about it? I mean, you had just gotten back. You hadn't been home a week before the earthquake hit. So where were you when you heard about the earthquake, and how quickly did you decide it was time to go back?
Well, I think like so many people that have their cell phones or hooked up for news alerts, I guess the earthquake hit shortly before 5 on January 12th, like you said, and it was about 5:15. My BlackBerry, sorry to use the code name there, but it rained off, and I looked, and it said the earthquake exceeding magnitude 7.0 hit Port-au-Prince. And the first thing I thought was, earthquake? Port-au-Prince? We've been going there forever. I never knew this was an earthquake-prone zone, and I've met many other people since that. Again, it just didn't think about it. We thought about the effects they have with hurricanes and famine and et cetera, but earthquakes. And I just stared. I pulled over and the side of the road because it was my car, and I just couldn't believe it. And then, but I mean, the immediate reaction was to start calling people and say, look, we got to get a prayer chain going. And that's what we did.
I want to bring your wife into this. Carol, it's so great to be able to talk to you. You're the best thing that ever happened to Mark. You know that, don't you?
Know about that.
I know about that, and it's great to be able to talk with both of you. But you went back with Mark on this trip. Did you have to think about it?
Not for too long. You know, my first thoughts were, how was I going to get the team organized and get supplies and all of the logistics that we would be facing. Before going to bed that evening of the earthquake, Mark looked at me and said, can we get back by Friday? And we both knew we would be back. It just, how long would it take us to get there? The big question in my mind was whether we would be prepared emotionally to see the devastation that would be around us. And then, of course, to prepare our children to release us to go into that kind of a situation weighed heavy on this mama's heart.
Were you at all involved in these aftershocks that we've heard about? I mean, I think the Port-au-Prince area experienced a 6.0 aftershock. Were you there at that time, Carol?
We actually were. The first big aftershock occurred, I think, at 6:03 in the morning, and we typically woke up at 6 o'clock every morning, Mark running around to everyone's door, knocking on it to get us up. He had just left our room, and our bed started shaking violently, and I thought, wow, okay, I'm up already. Then when I opened my eyes and saw the curtains fluttering and heard the building creaking, we quickly realized what was happening around us. Not an experience we'd had before, and I can't say we were filled with fear. Our first thought was, how quickly can we get back to the hospital, because people need us immediately.
And what is the hospital like? I mean, it seems to me that everything that we know about Haiti, even prior to the earthquake, is certainly third world. Did you find, Carol, that the hospital was adequately equipped to deal with the needs that were being presented there?
In American standards, no, it was not equipped. But in their standards, they were doing the best that they could. We were blessed to be in a position to come alongside and to help and be a helping assistant instead of running in and trying to take control and take charge. And while for some, especially like Mark, that was a humbling task, we knew that was the role that we needed to play in that. So it was a blessing to be able to come alongside and actually, there were many that I spoke to that questioned, you know, when are you going to leave us, and how are you going to leave us behind? And I explained to them that we were there to help, but that God was really the only one who would give them the wisdom and the direction to move forward. And that's who they need to look to, not to the Americans to come in.
My guests are Dr. Mark Atkinson and his wife, Carol. They've just returned from a medical missions trip to Haiti. One that they took in the aftermath of the earthquake there, but something they've been doing now for several years. And I'm going to take a quick break, and I promise only to keep you a short time when we come back from the break. But I do want to hear some of these stories. I know Carol has some very moving stories to share But I need to get this break in, and I want to encourage everyone to stay tuned for the real meat of the ministry that took place there in Haiti as a result of this medical missions team led by my friend Mark Atkinson and his wife Carol. More of the Paul Edwards program here on Faith Talk 1500.
I was thrilled. I was just awestruck at how quickly the extra pounds were just falling off of me.
Got a New Year's resolution to lose weight?
I used to wear an extra large T-shirt, you know, to cover everything. And now I wear a medium comfortably, kind of loose on me. That is really fantastic.
Try Jane's Method, the all-natural, original meta system from Judy Singer. Jane tried other products.
My gosh, I must have tried about 15 or 20 different products, and I just sort of gave up.
Then she found the meta system.
The first month, I lost many inches and about 15 pounds. I would recommend Judy Singer Meta System for anyone who is overweight. You'll feel better about yourself, you'll look better, your clothes will fit better, and you will lose sizes.
Kickstart your resolution. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. Online at themetasystem.com. The original Meta System from Judy Singer. The most powerful, natural way to lose weight. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Are you tired of paying $100 an hour for computer support just for the prompt to return? Hi, I'm Luke Ford, founder and CEO of My Computer Works. Whenever you have a major computer catastrophe or a simple question, give my U.S.-based computer technicians a call and they'll remotely connect your computer and fix the problem for you. It's safe, secure, and you won't have to let a stranger into your home. Call now to receive 1 month of service free with a membership. Now let's hear from some of our satisfied customers.
They cleaned up the computer and I sat there and watched everything going on. I was just having a ball.
So the convenience of having My Computer Works connect to my computer right then, fix it for me immediately, is priceless.
I was having a lot of major problems with my computer, and they basically evaluated the computer and went through and eliminated the problems I was having.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My Computer Works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the final round of our National Spelling Bee. Let's begin.
Christopher, your word is SIPC.
Could you use it in a sentence, please?
In the unlikely event that your brokerage firm goes out of business, SIPC is there to protect you.
SIPC. See?
I'm sorry, Christopher. Lisa, your word also is SIPC.
May I have that in another sentence, please?
SIPC funds are available to satisfy brokerage customer claims up to a maximum of $500,000, including up to $100,000 for cash claims.
SIPC. S-I-P-K.
Don't know about SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation? That's okay. We can spell it out for you. Learn more at www.sipc.org.
Welcome back to the Paul Edwards Program. Remember, information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here again is Paul Edwards.
My guest is Dr. Mark Atkinson, American Diabetes Association eminent scholar in the University of Florida's Department of Pathology, along with his wife, Carol, who just returned from a medical missions trip to Haiti. Mark and Carol and I attended high school together. That seems like such a long, long time ago. And Mark was in my wedding, and I was in his wedding, a day apart. That's how I know when his anniversary is. I can't remember my own, but I can remember Mark's. And Mark, before the break, we were talking about the reality on the ground there. I mean, after things are bad enough in Haiti prior to an earthquake, but when you made the decision to go back, logistically, did you run into any roadblocks, any speed bumps that kind of slowed you down or surprised you?
We did, and you know, it was a different experience than we normally have, in that normally when Carol and I, or most others who are arranging similar trips that may be in the audience, it takes 2 months, 4 months, even 6 months of planning to get something going. And for us, it was literally 36 hours between when we made the go, no-go decision and then before we were on our way. So everything was accelerated, and the answer is yes, we did have some surprising positive surprises, meaning ranging from the donation of supplies, the outpouring You know, we usually talk about ourselves being proud Christians. This was, again, one of those moments where I was proud to be an American. I mean, the outpouring of supplies that people were willing to load us up with going out. I mean, we literally had more than we could physically take with us, and that was incredibly positive. Another thing was not getting into politics, but again, during the bailout, you know, when the notion of corporate jets became a scarlet letter, per se, for CEOs to have. CEOs or corporations across the country, they've been donating their jets to fly teams into Haiti, meaning three major U.S. airlines that go in there, Spirit Air, American Airlines, and Delta. Again, sorry for the names, but, you know, they're banned from flying in now. So either you're going on a military transport or you have a made for private means. So the people and companies are donating flights was a very positive thing. And then another thing was just the promises and commitments of people to pray. We certainly had that beforehand, felt prayer covering before, during, and after. On the other side, I think we, within the, on the first day, we actually became very frustrated because of what I often call, what I'll call here, the suits versus scrubs phenomenon. Meaning our original military flight to go out that day was we right before we got to the airport, we learned that we had been bumped from our seats because some people from the State Department took priority over us. And then as we got close to the airport, we heard that the next day we were bumped again by State Department people. And from talking to others, I had the feeling this has happened, that there were a number of individuals that for political means or photo ops priority over people who are going down to actually, and not that it was all that, I don't want to get the wrong impression, but for whatever reasons, and they took priority over people who could actually come and help save lives, at least on a more acute basis. I think I was also surprised by some people that were there on the ground that were modern day charlatans. I mean, fuel was in short supply, food was in short supply, ability to travel was in short supply. But there were people there on the ground that week, within a day or two after the earthquake, that if you had the money and would pay anything, they could get you anywhere, they could get you anything. But they just travel the earth, you know, going from crisis to crisis for profit and charging 10, 20 times what a fair market value would be. So, there were positives and negatives, but you know, again, this is going back to prayer. When we had hit an obstacle, we pray about it, and God directed us through. It's just incredible.
What was your objective, Mark, as you made the quick plans to get back to Haiti with your team? What was your objective? I mean, did you know going in exactly what you thought you might be able to accomplish?
Well, I have to say, in full admission, while we're Carol and I, and maybe others that work trips like that, we're continual students. Every time we go, we try and learn something. And I must say that in the early years when we used to go with what we used to call the Santa Claus mentality, thinking that the solutions to, not only did the Haitians need God, as other countries do, and they have to have a saving knowledge of Christ, but that with a solution to their problems was by bringing stuff. And I mean, we used to go armed to the teeth with stuff. I mean, we would have our medications and go things, but like one year at our church, we had like a Beanie Baby drive. So we took 1,000 Beanie Babies. And one other year it was sunglasses and hats. And we took all this. Well, you know, for decades and decades, this is what the Haitians have known. They've had organizations, both secular and non, and faith-based, bring in stuff, and that's never solved their problem. So we adopted a couple years ago the plan that Rick Warren from Saddleback did, where he called it the Peace Plan.
Right.
And it's an acronym where, again, our goal is to, you know, make help the Haitians help themselves, teach them to fish, make them the heroes. You know, we're just a helping hand there. So we try in our trips to go down and, you know, bring them what they ask us for, meaning we'll ask them. And that's what happened on this trip. We made email contact with the pastor down there, one of our pastor churches, and he said, "What do you need?" And he said, "I've talked to the hospital director at St. Mark. They need doctors. Please come now. Hmm. So, and with the peace plan, that's what we did. He called, and we responded.
And what did you find the hospital to be like? I mean, Carol described it briefly, but from a doctor's perspective, what did you find the reality on the ground in terms of what you had to work with?
One word, chaos.
Hmm.
Absolute chaos. And maybe if I put it in numbers or quantitatively, your listeners will understand. St. Mark is a hospital that's about 50 kilometers, so say about 30 miles north of Port-au-Prince, where the epicenter of the earthquake was. They felt the effects in St. Mark, both in terms of the earthquake itself, but also the aftershocks, the aftermath, because this is like the first major town to the north of Port-au-Prince. So it's become the first major stop for refugees, people fleeing Port-au-Prince that are staying in Haiti. Many of them are going to St. Mark. Now, this is a town of before the earthquake, of about 250,000 people. Here we go. There is one hospital in this town for 250,000 people, and its capacity is about 60 under normal conditions.
Hmm. Hmm.
60 beds,
man,
or bed equivalents, 250,000 people.
Hmm.
I'm not sure about the geographic numbers in Detroit, but if you pictured all of Detroit having to work with 400 beds for the entire Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County area, that's the equivalent of what we faced when we got there.
Yeah, I think in this area there might be like 1.3 million people.
I'll give you 300 beds to service southeastern Michigan.
Man.
That's what it's like. And then even like Carol described, calling a hospital is really, by U.S. standards, is just a stretch. I mean, there's no... The running water not there. Electricity only comes from a generator. There's again no type of climate control. They moved for a few beds they had out because the patients were essentially stacked side by side. You know, any hallway, any office, even outside. It was just wherever there was space that you could find. And then the days when we were there early on and after the earthquake, it was just shoulder to shoulder people, because family members come in and others to help and want to see, and people were just scared. A lot of them didn't want to be in buildings, so they were just there. So chaos.
Dr. Mark Atkinson, my guest, his wife Carolyn, he just returned from Haiti on a medical missions trip. And Carol, I think I read in one of Mark's emails that somehow, some way, Geraldo Rivera came to be on your team. Is that a fact?
That's a fact. You know, it was an amazing thing, as you noted earlier. We certainly did not plan to spend two nights on the tarmac of an active airport with military transport planes coming in and out all evening, but that's what we did. And when we arrived, we saw Geraldo and his crew there, and we must have looked a little bit displaced because they came over and said, you know, camp out right here next to us and we'll keep an eye on you. We'll make sure you're safe. And then a little while later, two search and rescue guys that had come in from California, after working all long, hard day, they would come and lay on the concrete next to our team. And the Air Force chaplain brought us cots to sleep in for the evening. So it quickly became a community of people helping people.
Was there a single moment, Carol, in your experience this last time that stands out in your mind?
There are a lot of them, but one in particular on the end of the second to the last day, I felt God very much moving on my spirit to tell me to put away all of the busyness that I was getting, the supplies and, you know, all of the chaos, and to just take time to treat these people as people and hear their story and pray for them. I fought that because I knew it would be a very, very painful experience. But by the next morning, I had told the team to count me out, that my day would be spent ministering to people's needs in a very physical and spiritual way. And so moving cot to cot in a very loud, chaotic place, I found myself hearing story after story, each one just breaking my heart and stretching me to the limits of how I was to comfort them. one particular story, there was about an 18-year-old boy who was on a cot, and each day I would wave and smile as I went back and forth multiple times per day and somehow had built a connection. So I made a point to go and talk to him and hear his story. And he had been paralyzed from the waist down in the earthquake from the first one and gotten from Port-au-Prince to this hospital and had lay there. And every day that he couldn't move, he became more and more frightened. So as I talked with him, he shared that how frightened he was, but had shared his faith in Christ and how he had been set free through Christ. So we spoke about that his spirit would, even if his body never regained mobility, he would still be free indeed. And if he could just grasp hold of that. Then he further went on to tell me he had lost his mother and he was so frightened. And the more he talked, my emotions just began to bubble over and I could feel tears running down my cheeks. And he looked at me and said, "Why are you crying?" And I said, "I feel so badly for you." And he reached up and wiped my tears away and said, "But I'm going to be okay. Mm. You know, God is going to make this okay." So as we prayed together and as we finished, he looked up at me and said, "Thank you for coming. Mm. In your eyes, I feel like I see my mother." Mm. And wanted me to take a picture of him so that I would never forget him. Mm. And I assured him that forgetting him was not something that was going to happen. So that was a difficult moment, but one that I knew was part of the reason, if not the reason, I needed to go.
We've got just a few minutes left here, Mark. What does Haiti need? I mean, you talk about taking beanie babies and sunglasses and hats, and we've solved that problem. You know that we know that's they don't need more stuff. But when we think about what Haiti needs and what we can do, what are the answers to those questions?
Well, it's complex, and I'll be the humble and say, at many days or most hours of the day, I'll say I simply don't know. What's going to solve Haiti's problems. I know in the short term, all the things that you're hearing about, their need for clean water, absolutely. The need for food, absolutely. The need for medical care, not just short term, but long term, meaning that what's been created by this earthquake is a population of people that are, we have a whole slew of new amputees that need prosthetic devices. They need people that have training in physical therapy. They need some psychologists. They need structural engineers to go in and know what buildings are safe and what's not. So there's a lot of tangible things like that. But when you get beyond that, I think the greatest thing that people can do, and each of those form part of what I call hope. They need both physical hope and spiritual hope. And that's one of the things I think we should all pray for them, that no matter what we do, is that without hope, they're not going to survive, either here on Earth or throughout eternity. So we need to bring them hope.
Well, Mark, you and I are going to connect via email or by phone off the air, and I want to find out more from you about what this audience can do to specifically help. And I've already told you I'm ready to come down there and do what I can. To help. I have a great desire to get down there and actually be boots on the ground in a missions way to help. And I just appreciate your friendship so much. I appreciate knowing that you and Carol are faithfully serving Jesus in this way. And I appreciate you stopping by here and giving us this much time to share your story. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
Well, we're honored you speak on behalf of Carol and I. We're honored you to ask. Again, proud that you're being proactive in this, because this is not a simple problem that they face. And so it's kind of like a going back to the body example. It's going to take the giftings of many in order to help them. And one last thing, Paul, I'll say it again. This was another thing, lesson learned. We often think about what we're going to do for them, and it's like we're going to do for them, by far and away, when you come back, you've done so much more for yourself in doing this.
Yeah. Well, it's more blessed to give than to receive, isn't it?
It is. And we come back so blessed. And we're the ones, when you reach out like this, the people who do it are really the ones that are blessed.
We'll talk again, my friend. My love to both of you, and thanks so much for the time you've given us.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
54 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards Program.
It's Chris McCourtney of Faith Talk 1500. Happy New Year to each and every one of you. January means it's time for Family Life Today's live broadcast, slated for January 27, 28, and 29. Once again, Bob and Dennis will challenge us to come alongside this great ministry and support them as legacy partners for 2010. When you consider all of the challenges to the American family today, you can't help but want to support this great ministry. Between the challenges of gay marriage, divorce, abortion, sexual immorality, pornography, and more, the time to help is now. What will your legacy be? Please pick up the phone and call Family Life Today at 800-FL-TODAY or go to familylife.com and let them know you want to support this vital work. And join us at Faith Talk 1500 on January 27 through 29 at 7:30 a.m. for Family Life Today Live.
Has your computer been slowing down? Are you having problems with your email? Or when you go to the internet, is your browser taking so long to load that it seems like the worldwide wait? I'm Luke Ford, CEO of My Computer Works. We help people just like you with computer problems you can't fix. With one easy call, we can help you get your computer working the way you want it, speeding it back up, making sure you can send and receive emails, and making the internet fun again. You'll speak to a U.S.-based technician who knows what they're doing, who can usually fix your computer on the very first call. If your computer's been slowing down, you can't get your email to work, your internet's taking forever, or if you're not sure what's wrong, but your computer's just not working the way you want it, call My Computer Works, and we'll help you fast.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My Computer Works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
Are credit card bills stressing you out? Do you find yourself living paycheck to paycheck, hanging your head in embarrassment with $4,000 or more in unsecured debt? Call Consumer Education Services Incorporated, a nonprofit organization, for help. They'll give you a free consultation and a clear picture of how to permanently get out of debt. Here's the number.
800-948-6814, 800-948-6814, 800-948-6814.
Your goals include a college degree, traditional on campus or online, bachelor's, master's, or doctorate. Just starting college or ready to complete your degree. Visit ChristianCollegesNow.com. ChristianCollegesNow.com features all the tools you'll need in your search for the best Christian college or seminary and the ideal degree program. It's as simple as search, find, apply. ChristianCollegesNow.com is your central hub for higher Christian education with tips, advice, and tools for advanced planning. It's time for more than just a diploma. It's time for ChristianCollegesNow.com.
You're listening to the Paul Edwards Program on Faith Talk 1500.
Just about 58 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards Program, 866-423-WLQV is our phone number. And coming up after SRN News, Congressman Pete Hoekstra is going to be my guest. And I wonder what we're going to talk to the congressman about today. I mean, nothing significant happened yesterday, did it? Yes, I think the State of the Union address might be on the agenda, but I'll tell you what else is on the agenda. The terrorist, Christmas Day terrorist bomber, and everything to do with that. We'll talk with...
Are you tired of paying $100 an hour for computer support just for the problem to return? Hi, I'm Luke Ford, founder and CEO of My Computer Works. Whenever you have a major computer catastrophe or a simple question, give my U.S.-based computer technicians a call, and they'll remotely connect your computer and fix the problem for you. It's safe, secure, and you won't have to let a stranger into your home. Call now to receive 1 month of service free with a membership. Now let's hear from some of our satisfied customers.
They cleaned up the computer and I sat there and watched everything going on. I was just having a ball.
So the convenience of having My Computer Works connect to my computer right then, fix it for me immediately, is priceless.
I was having a lot of major problems with my computer, and they basically evaluated the computer and went through and eliminated the problems I was having.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My computer works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
The Equip for Life team asked our audience why they listen to Equip for Life with Pastor Christopher Brooks.
My name is Zakiya Bay and I live in Detroit. I first listened to Equip for Life the day after attending Answering the Challenge. I was so encouraged by just the things that I learned there, all of the questions that I had answered, and I wanted to see what else was being offered on the radio station because I can actually listen to that on the daily whenever I need it.
Equip for Life with Pastor Christopher Brooks can be heard Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on AM 1500 WLQV.
This is Faith Talk 1500, WLQV Detroit, a service of Salem Communications.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. Defendant Scott Roeder took the stand in Wichita, Kansas today. He is accused of killing abortionist Dr. George Tiller, and under questioning by his defense attorney, Mark Rudy, admitted the crime.
On May 31st, 2009, did you go to the Reformation Lutheran Church and shoot and kill George Tiller?
Yes.
His lawyers are hoping to show that Roeder based his actions partly on a belief that Tiller was breaking the law, a potential step toward a lesser conviction of voluntary manslaughter. Also at SRNNews.com, he wrote a novel that most Americans were probably required to read in high school. J.D. Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye, has died at the age of 91 at his home in New Hampshire. The Senate has voted to confirm Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke to a second term. SRN's Linda Kenyon has the story.
The current state of the economy has left Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke a polarizing figure in Washington. Kentucky Republican Senator Jim Bunning, one of Bernanke's most outspoken opponents, described the Fed chair as asleep at the switch, a man who arose to the occasion only in the last year and who missed many of the blatant signals of economic disaster along the way. In contrast, New Hampshire Republican Judd Gregg described Bernanke as a strong hand at the tiller during an economic crisis who helped avert even more dire economic consequences. And Gregg acknowledged Bernanke isn't perfect, but he also said he believes Bernanke is the best person for the job. Linda Kenyon, Washington.
While Toyota is having major problems with accelerator pedals in its model cars, Ford Motor Company is showing its first profit in 4 years. Auto analyst David Cole, chairman of the Center for Automotive Research, says Ford's profit is especially impressive because of the economic recession.
The auto industry has been through a depression, and to be profitable at the strength of the market that we have is an amazing feat. And what it means is that they've made very significant structural changes.
Ford says it benefited from cost-cutting, debt reduction, and popular cars and trucks like the Ford Fusion sedan. On Wall Street, the Dow down by 116 points. This is SRN News.
From the Center for God and Culture and the studios of Faith Talk 1500, welcome to the Paul Edwards Program. Information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here now is Paul Edwards.
Alistair Begg once told me that I have a propensity for overgeneralizing, and I may be overgeneralizing when I say that last night's State of the Union address has got to be one of the most combative, arrogant State of the Union addresses I have ever witnessed in my life. Welcome into the Paul Edwards program. All across southeastern Michigan, northwest Ohio, and parts of Ontario, Canada, here in the Center for the Study of God and Culture, 866-423-WLQV is the phone number, and you can instant message me in studio at the website at godandculture.com. You know, the President of the United States has enjoyed unprecedented majorities of his party in both houses of Congress. He had a supermajority for a little while until the Massachusetts earthquake a couple of weeks ago. Supermajority and still not able to get his agenda through. And yet last night, he blames the Republicans for what ails America, blames the Republicans for the president not being able to get his agenda through, and he did it in this way.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills. And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well. Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership. We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
I'm sure that our guest here, Congressman Pete Hoekstra, was in the House last night when all of this was taking place. Of course, Congressman Hoekstra, a regular guest here on the program, representing Michigan's 2nd Congressional District and the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. And, Congressman, welcome into the program again.
Hey, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
What do you make of the lecture that the president – have you ever had a president kind of, talk to you like Charlie Brown's teacher and tell you it's your fault that the school's in such a mess?
Actually, I think your comments pretty much echo and mirror mine. The president last night, I thought there would be some a little bit more conciliatory, saying, hey, let's work together. It's been a rough first year. But you're absolutely right. He came in and he lectured, and it was one of the more partisan speeches that I'd seen, both in the tone and the tenor looking forward, but also looking back. And what the president forgets is that the Democrats started building these large majorities in Congress in 2006, so they've been on a run in D.C. and he keeps blaming everything on the former administration.
Yeah.
When actually, excuse me, you were part of the majority in the Senate back in 2007 and 2008.
I noticed last night that the last 8 years have now become the last decade. Is that significant?
I think so, because it now includes the first year of his presidency. And it's, when you have, a really bad run of 8 years, as the president keeps wanting to say, of course there's going to be a hangover effect that he's not accountable for, that may last 2, 3, 4 years. And, we saw that very much, that same strategy and embraced by Governor Granholm, where for years she has blamed, first it was the Engler administration for leaving her a mess, and then in blaming the Bush administration for the mess that she was in, and never taking ownership or responsibility, even though she was governor.
Was the president speaking to his base last night? Because certainly, as a conservative Republican like myself, I heard very little in that speech. It seemed to me that the applause lines that he crafted into his speech, or his speechwriter crafted in, were things that the Republicans didn't have any choice to but to stand up and applaud. For instance, things like, the things he said about the American military, or we don't want America to be second. Well, nobody wants America to be second, but we can certainly argue about how to get America to be first.
Yeah, and, he was speaking to his base, but there were a couple of things I thought that were very interesting that he omitted in his speech. He never mentioned Gitmo, and he never mentioned moving the trials to New York City, where, for most of the last year, closing Gitmo has kind of been the cornerstone of saying, look, we're going to have change. And on these kinds of issues, today Senator Feinstein came out and said, move the trial out of New York City. Earlier this week, Senators Webb and Landrieu both said, move the trials out of New York City. So for a couple of the president's signature programs that signaled change that you could believe in, he's walking away from, but he's not talking about him anymore.
Closer to home, right here in Milan, Michigan, I think he's still in the federal prison in Milan. Abdul Muttalib, better known as the Christmas Day terror bomber on the Northwest Airlines flight. He's now being treated as a civilian criminal, as if he's a typical arsonist who maybe tried to start some fires on Devil's Night in the city of Detroit, rather than the international terrorist that he is. What is the feeling of the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee on what's how the state, and by state I mean the Obama administration, is treating Abdul Muttalib?
Well, I think my views are directly in line with the people who headed up the 9/11 commission after the attack on 9/11, and many other prominent law enforcement and national security personnel, including I think even the director of national intelligence, all of whom have said this guy should have been put into military detention. He should have been interrogated. And he should never have been put into civilian courts and read his Miranda rights after 55 minutes of being under arrest, when the guy was clearly in severe pain, and who knew whether what he was saying had any value or merit. We should have treated his physical injuries, put him into military interrogation, and gotten as much information from him as possible. This is a guy that just came from Yemen. This is a guy that met with Anwar Awlaki in Yemen, the American radical-born cleric that has been, you know, targeting Americans to try to get them to convert to radical Islam. This is a guy that probably met with al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. They're the ones that prepared the bomb materials for him, that talked to him about how to maybe perhaps detonate this bomb. You know, because do you really believe they only built one of these underwear or underpants bombs, whatever you call it? They probably built more, and he would have had insights into that. But as soon as they read him as Miranda rights, he shut up.
Congressman Pete Hoekstra, my guest here on the Paul Edwards Program, the ranking member of on the House Intelligence Committee, serving the 2nd Congressional District right here in Michigan. Are we going to be able to go back now? I mean, is there a move afoot, hopefully, in Congress and in our intelligence areas, in the State Department, to move this guy out of the civilian courts and put him where he belongs in a military tribunal?
There's a move, but on whether it's closing Gitmo, whether it's moving the trials out of New York City, or whether it's taking this guy out of the civilian system and putting him into, into the military system, it appears that this administration is not going to change its position. The president or his spokesperson was rather defiant, as recently as I think today, say, the president agrees with the decisions that Eric Holder has made in all of these cases. He supports them, and they see no reason to change their mind, even though they are losing support from law enforcement, intelligence, and intelligence professionals, saying this is just the wrong direction to go, and you're jeopardizing our national security.
I want to play you one more clip before I let you go from last night's speech, where the president took the SCOTUS to task, the Supreme Court of the United States. This seems unprecedented. I want to find out from you as a House member whether or not you think it is. Here's the president last night taking on the Supreme Court.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interests, or worse, by foreign entities. They should be decided by the American people. And I'd urge Democrats and Republicans to pass a bill that helps correct some of these problems.
Congressman Samuel Alito certainly didn't hold back mouthing the words simply untrue to the president as he made this case. And turns out it is simply untrue that that what the Supreme Court did opens up campaign funding to foreign entities. It's just not true.
Yeah, and I think and this is not about how we would like the law to be. We have the opportunity to do that. They shouldn't be scolding this. He shouldn't be scolding the Supreme Court for interpreting the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It's Congress's responsibility to pass laws that meet constitutional muster. And if what we did didn't pass constitutional muster, then it's our responsibility to go back to work and do that. And so the challenge should be, last night should not have been the president scolding the Supreme Court, which I think in 18 years I've never seen happen before. And regardless of the president's statement saying, you know, in due respect, no, it's not respect, it's disrespectful. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court didn't have the opportunity to stand up and say, excuse me, Mr. President, if Congress had passed a law that had passed constitutional muster, we wouldn't be having this problem. It's the responsibility the Supreme Court to interpret the laws. It's our responsibility to pass laws that pass constitutional muster. If we fail at that level, then we need to go back to the drawing boards and pass a new bill, and that's the opportunity and the challenge now in front of us.
Does what the president did last night in scolding the Supreme Court publicly go to what he did on the campaign trail when he said that the Constitution, he told some radio host somewhere, Representative Hoekstra, that the Constitution was a flawed document. Do you think this president fundamentally thinks that the Constitution is flawed and therefore really does believe that the executive branch can call on the carpet the judicial branch who is held responsible for interpreting it?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that approach, but it very much could imply that that he believes that, you know, the Supreme Court should be more of a political body responding to the political pressures and the, you know, the wide-held views of today, commonly held views today, rather than, you know, the Constitution, which is their benchmark.
Congressman.
So, I appreciate the time. Good being with you.
Well, you've given me more time than I asked for, and I appreciate you giving me this much time. Congressman Pete Hoekstra of the 2nd Congressional District and ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, best to you, sir.
Hey, great. Thank you.
15 minutes after the hour, more on Faith Talk 1500.
Attention car owners, if your vehicle has less than 120,000 miles or if your current warranty is about to expire, this message is for you. You can now get extended coverage for your vehicle at much lower rates than dealers offer. How? By cutting out the middleman. Logic Car Care has set up a special toll-free number so you can get a free, no-obligation quote direct. $5,000 engine replacements and other expensive repairs will cost you nothing. You pick the repair shop and we'll pick up the bill. Plus, receive free 24-hour roadside assistance, low monthly payments, and free towing. Feel secure knowing each plan is backed by a solid A-rated insurance company admitted in all 50 states. It's coverage that's customized to meet your needs. Be one of the first 15 callers with your insurance card and mileage and get a 25% discount by mentioning this ad. Call now for your free quote. 800-483-0257. That's 800-483-0257. Don't wait. Call 800-483-0257. That's 800-483-0257.
1,500 pastors leave the ministry every month, never to return. 70% of pastors fight depression. All pastors and their spouses need support, and the Evangelical Pastors Network is here to help. The Evangelical Pastors Network is a new local organization by pastors for pastors. We at Faith Talk 1500 and Detroit Rescue Mission Ministries are excited to partner with EPN for their inaugural dinner on Monday, February 1st at the San Marino Club in Troy with special guest speaker H.B. London, who heads pastoral ministry for Focus on the Family. Simply visit evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com and register today. The cost is only $20 for your spouse and you, or $10 for individuals. Register today, visit evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com or call 248-627-2513. That's evangelicalpastorsnetwork.com or call 248-627-2513.
Information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here again is Paul Edwards on Faith Talk 1500.
17 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards program. You know, the reality is we wouldn't have enough time to play all of the clips from the president's speech last night that I find quite provocative. There were any number. I'll be honest, what I wanted to do was put together all of the clips where he talked about himself and run Carly Simon's You're So Vain underneath it, because, you know, the man is just full of himself. But we're dealing with the most flagrant things that the president said, unprecedented for a president to call on the carpet the Supreme Court of the United States as they sit in front of him. And Justice Samuel Alito, I think rightly so, could not contain himself and mouthed the words simply untrue. And it is untrue what the president said when the court overturned part of McCain-Feingold, the campaign finance reform law. The president indicated that this would open the floodgates to foreign corporations to invest in political campaigns here in the United States. That is blatantly false. The president is a constitutional scholar. He's a professor of law. He ought to know this. He is either blatantly mistaken or blatantly misrepresenting the facts. According to Bradley Smith at National Review's The Corner, the court held that 2 United States Code Section 441A, which prohibits all corporate political spending, is unconstitutional. foreign nationals, specifically defined to include foreign corporations, are prohibited from making, quote, a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, or to make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in connection with a federal, state, or local election under 2 U.S. United States Code Section 441E, which was not at issue in the case. The president absolutely misrepresented the facts. And so Samuel Alito was absolutely right to mouth the words to the president, simply not true. It is not true that what the Supreme Court has done is open the floodgates to foreign corporations to influence elections here in the United States. What the Supreme Court did is undo what McCain-Feingold did, which would hamstring American corporations from influencing elections and letting their voice be heard. And these people are Americans. I think that when the president talks about corporate America, we think that this is some gray and steel building, some blue-gray building somewhere, that's corporate America. Corporate America is made up of Americans. How do you justify silencing a large majority of Americans from having a voice in the outcome of elections in this country? That's what the Supreme Court of the United States overturned, and the president got it flat wrong. He also got some other things wrong from my perspective. Here's one last clip from the president last night at his State of the Union address.
Abroad, America's greatest source of strength has always been our ideas. The same is true at home. We find unity in our incredible diversity, drawing on the promise enshrined in our Constitution. The notion that we're all created equal, that no matter who you are or what you look like, if you abide by the law, you should be protected by it. If you adhere to our common values, you should be treated no different than anyone else. We must continually renew this promise. My administration has a civil rights division that is once again prosecuting civil rights violations and employment discrimination. We finally strengthened. We finally strengthened our laws to protect against crimes driven by hate. This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are. It's the right thing to do.
You know, the reality is, my friends, it may be the right thing to do, but it's not. From the president's perspective, it may be the right thing to do, but we discriminate against people on the basis of behavior all the time. If somebody, there are people in lunatic asylums that obey the law, but we discriminate against them because they are lunatics. The fact of the matter is, from certainly a Christian perspective, homosexuality is a sin. Just like adultery is a sin, just like pedophilia, I should say. These are sins. These are sexual sins. Homosexuality, it's clear in Scripture. Sexual sin. And the notion that that we can sanction this behavior in our military, for instance, if you get a transgendered male who decides he wants to bunk with the females, who's going to stop him if you don't have don't ask, don't tell? These are the kind of social issues that the president hasn't quite thought through. And, of course, the Joint Chiefs of Staff sat there stone-faced last night as they listened to the president push a social agenda on the American military. I'll tell you, the American military has enough to deal with in keeping us safe that they don't need the added pressure of having to worry about what the guy or the gal or the guy-gal in the bunk next to them is thinking. 866-423-WLQV is our phone number. When we continue, what's going on at Wheaton College? Wheaton, of course, is a flagship school of evangelical Christianity. Some of you in this audience have attended there yourselves, matriculated those halls. Others have had your children go there. They are in the process of selecting a new president. Dwayne Litvin is retiring after a 17-year stint there as president. And Andrew, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, we'll get the correct pronunciation if I've got it wrong. Dr. Andrew Chignall is a philosophy professor at Cornell, and he's written an excellent, excellent analysis, I think, of what to expect in the presidential search and its aftermath at Wheaton College. This is very important to the future of evangelicalism, and we'll chat with Dr. Andrew Chignall when the Paul Edwards program continues.
Hi, I'm John Wallace, president of Azusa Pacific University. Today, more than ever, I understand how important a college degree can be. I also understand the sacrifice of earning a college degree, especially in today's economy. This coming year, I invite you to consider Azusa Pacific. Log on to apu.edu and find a program that's right for you. I sure hope to see you this coming semester.
Call 877-81-ONLINE. That's 877-81-ONLINE. Begin the new year with Azusa Pacific University.
When the wolves from the credit card company come knocking at your door, it takes a toll on everyone. The associates of the Debt Relief Desk want you to know you don't have to do this alone. In 1 5-minute free consultation, you can discover how debt negotiation can work to relieve the burden of overwhelming credit debt or medical bills. Get a professional debt negotiator to stand between you and your creditors. The Debt Relief Desk. Relief starts here. Call today. 800-375-1165. 800-375-1165.
Hello, this is Scott Thunder for Bible League International. I want to take a moment to thank the WLQV listening family for supporting our Fill Their Empty Hands campaign this past fall. I want to especially thank the 227 people who gave to Bible League International for the first time. Your partnership is a huge encouragement to us in these uncertain times. WLQV sent more than 7,300 Bibles to the Philippines, Vietnam, Cambodia, and other countries in Southeast Asia. Think for a moment what a happy new year it's going to be for those who received their first Bible. While much was accomplished, there's still much more good we can do together. There are still hundreds of thousands waiting to hear the gospel in Southeast Asia. Your continued support would be a huge help right now. Just a dollar a day could send 90 Bibles by this time next year. Call 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673, or visit us online, 1-800-YES-WORD.com. Thanks again, WLQV. Happy New Year.
Is your child disrespectful, defiant, or obnoxious? Does everything turn into an argument with your kid? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman. I'll help you turn your child's behavior around right now with the Total Transformation.
After the Total Transformation, there's no more arguing, no more lecturing, no more back-talking. Now when I ask him to do something, he does it.
We've learned verbiage from the Total Transformation program, and it's almost like magic. If you say those words, they stop arguing.
Defiance, back-talking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. The Total Transformation will help you solve even the worst behavior problems. I guarantee your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back in your home.
Call now and get how to turn your child's attitude around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-217-9318. 1-800-217-9318. Call now. 1-800-217-9318.
Welcome back to the Paul Edwards Program. Remember, information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here again is Paul Edwards.
I'll remind you once again that I am fully cognizant of my propensity to overstate things, but I don't know that I'm overstating things when I say that Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, though it's far, far away from Detroit, it's not that far away from Detroit, but though it's way over there and we're way over here, that as goes Wheaton, so goes evangelicalism. And one of the concerns that we always have about Christian liberal arts schools is the fear, as we look back at history, I mean, good grief, Yale, I think, Yale, Harvard, they all began as seminaries of sorts. They all began with Christian foundations. There is some semblance of those roots in some nuances of those particular universities, but certainly far from the original mission. And you wonder if a flagship evangelical school like Wheaton, with its long history, might not eventually go the way of Yale and Harvard. And this is the question that is being raised In the SOMA review, the Society of Mutual Autopsy, it's at www.somareview.com. Wither Wheaton is the piece written by Dr. Andrew Chignell, who is associate professor in the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell University, and himself an alumnus of Wheaton College. And Dr. Chignell, it's an honor to welcome you here to the Paul Edwards Program.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be with you.
Is it your concern that that Wheaton may end up going the way of Yale and Harvard and maybe move farther to the left than its conservative, dare I say, fundamentalist roots?
I don't think that's so much my concern. I think that Wheaton, I mean, there was this period in the 20s and so forth when a lot of the colleges that you're mentioning and some of the smaller colleges that are more like Wheaton, Oberlin and whatnot, did go in that direction. You can see that in George Marsden's pretty well-known book, The Soul of the American University. He tells this story, but Wheaton came through that period by pushing pretty hard to the sort of biblically orthodox and strong inerrancy theory and things like that about the Bible. And so I don't think that's so much the concern now. I think in a way it's the ongoing attempt to hold off that sort of thing that gets Wheaton into trouble, or that's what the article was trying to suggest.
Yeah, this all centers around the fact that Wheaton is entering into a period of transition. I'm assuming, I don't know that you explicitly say this in your piece, but Dwayne Litvin is ending 17 years. You do say that, but
That's right.
You don't give the reason why. Is he retiring?
I think he's just retiring. Yeah.
And so the center point of your piece is this opportunity to transition to a different kind of administration or administrator than Dwayne Litvin has been. What kind of administrator has Dwayne Litvin been in terms of his relationship with the faculty and his protection of what he perceives to be the mission and the historic evangelical basis of Wheaton?
Well, that's the main topic of the piece, in a way. I mean, what's happened at Wheaton over the last 17 years during President Litvin's administration? I was there actually when he came. That was my first year, the year that they searched and found him. Is that I think a certain kind of alarm took over the administration, or maybe the Board of Trustees, and they moved to pick somebody who was a very well-regarded pastor from Tennessee. He did have a PhD from Oxford in New Testament, I mean, fully qualified person, but somebody who was going to push the college in the direction of its historical sort of roots and keep off the barbarians, as it were, who might be threatening it from the left. And as a result, I mean, he saw that as his mandate, and he has done various things, some of which were just a matter of somebody coming from a church and into an academic community, which has very different mores and traditions, but some of which were a result of his seeing this as his mandate. He did, I describe in the piece, four or five different episodes, but there have been a number of other ones where he uses his role as the mouthpiece of Wheaton's interpretation of certain scriptural texts or certain doctrines, the statement of faith that everybody has to sign, in order to question faculty, deny people tenure, ask people to leave the school, not allow departments to interview or hire people that they were interested in, and generally really have a sort of heavy hand in the whole administrative process in ways that previous administrators hadn't so much.
You quote, and I'm not sure if this is a professor at Wheaton, you characterize him as the geologist Greenberg.
Yeah, earlier I say he's a professor of geology.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He is quoted at towards the end of your piece that in respect to the transition that's getting ready to take place, quote, one hopes that an important lesson has been learned, and I'm assuming he means from the Litvin administration.
Right.
Legalism never works. How do we distinguish between legalism in the sense of all that that brings up in your mind versus a mandate that Dwayne Litvin felt he had to protect the core values and the missional purpose of Wheaton? Could it I mean, is the professor simply trying to say he was legalistic in the way he went about it, or that the very doing of it is legalistic?
Yeah, good question. I think he's suggesting that the way it was done was legalistic. So I think nobody disputes that Wheaton's got this special missional aspect, that it's got a statement of faith. My article was by no means meant to challenge Wheaton's right or privilege in having such things. I think all of us who, well, not all of us, but certainly many of us who went there, my father taught there for 25 years, my brother is a student there right now, value that part of the Wheaton character. It sets it apart from many of the rest of the colleges in the U.S. But, you know, you can implement these things in ways that allow for more or less kind of loving disagreement between people who share a lot of common ground. So some of the stories I tell in the piece are about how Litvin and his current provost have insisted on sort of hammering out their interpretations of certain aspects of the statement of faith, or even in one case, the preamble to the statement of faith, and insist that if people don't sign on and endorse their exact interpretation, then there's trouble. And in one case, somebody got fired. So I think the thought is, look, there are plenty of statements that we can all agree we have to sign, but I think that reasonable people can also interpret things in somewhat different ways. That doesn't mean anything goes. It's not obviously just a slippery slope, but reasonable people can differ, and certainly in an academic environment, we have to leave some space for that kind of creative disagreement.
Dr. Andrew Chignell is my guest. He is associate professor in the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell, and his website, www.chignell.org, chignell.org. I'm taking from reading your piece, Andrew, that there was a bit of, is animosity too strong of a word, from the get-go between the faculty and the Board of Trustees that ended up calling Litvin and then carrying on into his administration as if there really wasn't a whole lot of inclusion from by the Board of Trustees in seeking the input of the faculty and their participation in the selection process 17 years ago.
That's right. I mean, this is, in a way, ancient history, but it's true that at that time they saw the faculty as potentially going, you know, down the road to Oberlin, as yeah. we say sometimes.
Right.
And I mean, Oberlin was founded by Charles Finney, great evangelist, and so there's a certain parallel. And it's an exact contemporary of Wheaton, and so they did. They saw themselves as having to kind of rein in the faculty. And there are various rumors about how there was another very prominent, the provost of Notre Dame, actually, at the time, Wheaton grad, who was everybody's choice, and the Board of Trustees, sort of to show the faculty who is boss, chose this person that they'd never heard of from a church in Tennessee, came in with a very different sort of profile and mission. So, yeah, there was a lot of acrimony, and then when Litvin came in, I think there was a little bit of an attempt to sort of prove that he was up to the job, and so he started, the first thing he did was start asking the science faculty to sign on to a precise interpretation of what they thought the origins of life part of the statement says. And if you didn't agree with the precise interpretation that Litvin had, then you had 1 year to get yourself into the position where you agree, or else you were asked to leave for a new appointment. That obviously caused a huge uproar. And in the end, one of the trustees had to step in and ask Litvin to back down, but the sort of tone had been set.
Well, you know, it's interesting, as you kind of trace the history of President Litvin's tenure, he did sign on to climate change, but yet is kind of hesitant, not hesitant, but blatantly stonewalling against any kind of free thought on the in the area of Genesis 1 through 3. You know, let's leave that alone. But then you throw Christina Van Dyck into the mix,
right?
And you really get a sense for Litvin's real desire. I mean, almost to maintain a fundamentalist mentality there. Although I don't think he would appreciate the characterization as fundamentalist.
Yeah. So that story is, I mean, in a way, it can be a red herring because it involves the issue of homosexuality, which, you know, is a hot button issue for many people, but I didn't want to focus on that particular issue. Litvin and Wheaton have an interpretation of the Bible and of tradition that says that that's a sin, and they, you know, are explicit about that. But the Van Dyke story was interesting, not so much because of that issue, but because of the hermeneutical interpretive sort of question that I've been trying to get at with the piece. Van Dyke was a candidate for a position. A department strongly supported her to come down and have an interview. She signed off on the statement of faith, the thing I was just describing, which contains the claim that homosexuality is a sin, but it also contains the claim that the Bible clearly says that homosexuality is a sin. And what she did was put an asterisk there, a clarification, and say that she thought perhaps in the ancient world there weren't the sorts of same-sex relations, monogamous, committed, etc., that we know of today, and so that in a way the Bible might not be talking about the same sort of relationships. So she put that little clarification in, but still signed the statement, and she didn't say she thought that this wasn't a sin or something like that. But still, that was enough for the provost and the president to step in and say the department couldn't even interview her.
Yeah, the other issue becomes evangelicals and Catholics together. It seems, and I've been trying to think all day, Andrew, of a creative way to put this, but it seems to me that Dwayne Litvin was interested in protecting the evangelical purity of Wheaton and keep it strictly evangelical in every sense of the word, and not allow a Catholic influence at all, and yet he ended up losing. Mark Knoll ends up leaving, although he makes it clear it really wasn't for that reason, although it certainly could have had something to do with that. But where is Wheaton in terms of its devotion strictly to an evangelical interpretation of Scripture, you know, the doctrines of grace, the five solas and that sort of thing, Reformation, the Reformation versus the Vatican?
I think that there's quite a bit more openness on the part of at least much of the constituency and the administration. I think the homosexuality issue is something that they will go down with the ship on, so to speak, if they lose their tax-exempt status. I mean, you know, I don't know if that's the sort of thing that would be on the horizon at some stage for places like Wheaton, but I think they would not change their view. I think that's important to them. But on the Catholic and Orthodox issue, I think the faculty and many people in the administration and in the constituency are open to more engagement. I mean, I think clearly that in the culture, there's a lot more commonality between evangelicals and Catholics and even some Orthodox than there is between evangelicals and some of their secular counterparts. So this document that Mark Knoll, prominent historian, was working on in 94 and put out is encouraging this sort of dialogue, you know, not absorbing the Protestant churches back into Rome by any means, but, you know, why couldn't a Catholic work at Wheaton and bring that sort of point of view to bear without proselytizing students or something like that? So I just feel like the administration in that case was out of step with what I think was the majority feeling, that this wasn't something to sound the alarm about. But they did, and they said sola scriptura, this is a Reformation institution, this guy wants to become Catholic, we're going to have to kick him out. And I think that, again, raised a lot of eyebrows.
Well, you can certainly see, Andrew, I think that any move towards towards Rome might be seen as a dipping of the toe in the Tiber, the Tiber, however you pronounce that river there in
right,
Rome. An evangelical institution with the history of Wheaton certainly wants to protect its doctrinal orthodox integrity, and to employ a stated Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you maintain your doctrinal, your commitment to your historic confessions when you've got a faculty member who certainly could sign on to the essence of what Wheaton's doctrinal statement says? But I mean, everybody in this audience and you and I both know that there are real chasms between evangelicals and Catholics when it comes to the doctrine of regeneration, justification, and so forth.
Well, I think this, in a way, is Wheaton's advantage. It's not a denominational school. It's an inter or non-denominational evangelical institution, and I think there might be evangelical Catholics in some sense that could sign the statement of faith as Wheaton lays it out. In fact, this guy, Josh Hochschild, was claiming that he could. And there's nothing in that statement that says, you know, sola scriptura. Now, Litvin suggested that there was something in the preamble that, you know, allied Wheaton with the Reformation, and that may be true, but I don't see the big threat to a place like Wheaton if they were to allow, you know, with some care, the right sorts of Catholic, Orthodox, et cetera, scholars into the community. I just think it would be an enriching thing for them and something they could benefit from. But the administration disagrees.
Did I overstate the case at the beginning, Andrew, when I said that as goes Wheaton, so goes evangelicalism?
I don't know. I mean, some of the response I've had to this article suggests that many evangelicals think Wheaton has already gone somewhere down that slope.
Yep, right. Yep.
So, you know, there are the people at other schools like, Liberty or Bob Jones or something like that, who already view Wheaton as just about where Harvard is or something. But
When I was a kid in high school, Wheaton was the liberal evangelical school.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah, so... but I've since come to temper my opinion of it. When we, I got to let you go. But when we think about Wheaton, there are a lot of people in this audience who have kids at Liberty, Bob Jones.
Yeah.
Are there lessons that are universal from the Wheaton experience that apply across the board to these Christian liberal arts colleges and universities?
Well, I mean, the Wheaton experience is hard to sum up in one short soundbite, but I mean, I think the experience of this article, which, I mean, one thing we didn't talk about was that it was invited and then canceled twice by Christianity Today, which is located in Wheaton, Illinois. I think that is something that, you know, everyone at Wheaton, even the president, in an article that, you know, he was interviewed by Inside Higher Ed over this whole thing, he said he welcomed the dialogue, the discussion, and was regretting that the CEO of Christianity Today had decided to cancel it for reasons we don't know. But I think it was fear and a lack of a desire to really articulate differences among fellow believers who want to discuss things honestly and charitably disagree sometimes. That kind of attitude, I think, you know, I don't know if it's there at places like Bob Jones and others, but I suspect it is somewhat, and that, I think, is the most damaging thing. So Wheaton, I think, is maybe better on that score and could be a sort of direction for the others.
So much more I could ask you about, but they're waving me off. They say I got to pay some bills, but it's an excellent piece, and I want to point people in the audience to it. It's at www.somareview.com. The piece is Wither Wheaton. It's written by Dr. Andrew Chignell, and his website, www.chignell.org. It's just an excellent piece. It was very stimulating for me to read, and I'm honored to have had the opportunity, Andrew, to chat with you about it.
Well, thanks very much, Paul. It's great to be with you.
47 minutes after the hour.
Attention car owners, if your vehicle has less than 120,000 miles or if your current warranty is about to expire, this message is for you. You can now get extended coverage for your vehicle at much lower rates than dealers offer. How? By cutting out the middleman. Logic Car Care has set up a special toll-free number so you can get a free, no-obligation quote direct. $5,000 engine replacements and other expensive repairs will cost you nothing. You pick the repair shop and we'll pick up the bill. Plus, receive free 24-hour roadside assistance, low monthly payments, and free towing. Feel secure knowing each plan is backed by a solid A-rated insurance company admitted in all 50 states. It's coverage that's customized to meet your needs. Be one of the first 15 callers with your insurance card and mileage and get a 25% discount by mentioning this ad. Call now for your free quote. 800-483-0257. That's 800-483-0257. Don't wait. Call 800-483-0257. That's 800-483-0257.
It's Chris McCourtney of Faith Talk 1500. Happy New Year to each and every one of you. January means it's time for Family Life Today's live broadcast, slated for January 27, 28, and 29. Once again, Bob and Dennis will challenge us to come alongside this great ministry and support them as legacy partners for 2010. When you consider all of the challenges to the American family today, you can't help but want to support this great ministry. Between the challenges of gay marriage, divorce, abortion, sexual immorality, pornography, and more, the time to help is now. What will your legacy be? please pick up the phone and call Family Life today at 800-FL-TODAY or go to familylife.com and let them know you want to support this vital work. And join us at Faith Talk 1500 on January 27 through 29 at 7:30 a.m. for Family Life Today Live.
Hello, I'm Franklin Graham. As Christians, our beliefs are under attack more than they've ever been. I'm asking you to join with the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and Christianity.com to openly declare your faith. Please take a few moments to say, "I am a Christian," at Christianity.com. Stand up and be counted with me and others, and also learn more about sharing Christ here and around the world. Join hands with us and boldly declare your faith in Jesus Christ. Go to Christianity.com today.
If you're a diabetic, let me personally recommend a company to you called the Diabetes Line. If you call us right now, we can deliver your diabetic testing supplies to your home with no out-of-pocket costs. And getting your supplies delivered right to your door is as easy as calling this number right now, 24 hours a day. 800-344-2066, 800-344-2066, 800-344-2066.
On Faith Talk 1500.
50 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards program. 866-423-WLQV is our phone number, 866-423-9578. The New York Times today, not a newspaper known to be in the corner of conservatives, has a rather lengthy piece suggesting that the president calling out the Supreme Court for its overturning of parts of McCain-Feingold, the campaign finance reform law. The president is wrong. Samuel Alito is right. You don't often find the liberals at the New York Times talking this way. And what are they talking about? Of course, they're talking about this from last night.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interests, or worse, by foreign entities. They should be decided by the American people. And I'd urge Democrats and Republicans to pass a bill that helps correct some of these problems.
You hear the president there say that he doesn't want American corporations basically financing the campaigns of people. No, who the president wants to finance American elections are unions, because unions vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and corporate America is overwhelmingly conservative. And for the president to use the dignity of a State of the Union address to dress down the Supreme Court as they sit in front of him is beyond the pale, my friends. It is probably one of the most undignified, uncouth things I have ever heard or seen a president do. Pete Hoekstra was on at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. He minced no words. He says in 18 years in the House of Representatives, sitting through 9 or 10 State of the Union addresses, actually more than that, he has never, ever heard a president diss another branch of the government as President Obama did last night. The reality is, my friends, the president owes the Supreme Court an apology. Highly doubt they'll get it, but the fact of the matter is he owes them an apology.
Has your computer been slowing down? Are you having problems with your email? Or when you go to the internet, is your browser taking so long to load that it seems like the worldwide wait? I'm Luke Ford, CEO of My Computer Works. We help people just like you with computer problems you can't fix. With one easy call, we can help you get your computer working the way you want it. Speeding it back up, making sure you can send and receive emails, and making the internet fun again. You'll speak to a U.S.-based technician who knows what they're doing, who can usually fix your computer on the very first call. If your computer's been slowing down, you can't get your email to work, your internet's taking forever, Or if you're not sure what's wrong, but your computer's just not working the way you want it, call My Computer Works, and we'll help you fast.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My Computer Works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
Every day, millions of Americans are putting themselves at risk just by writing a check, using a credit card, or an ATM. We're talking identity theft. And that's why the National Foundation for Credit Counseling has compiled a list of tips to help reduce the risk of having your personal information stolen. Never give out personal or account information when responding to a phone or email inquiry unless you initiated the transaction. Open your credit card and other bills promptly and reconcile your receipts and accounts. Just because your credit card is in your wallet, it doesn't mean you're not at risk. Skimming or stealing credit and debit card numbers is a huge part of identity theft. If you've been a victim or think your personal information has been compromised, you need to act immediately. The identity theft recovery process can be long and daunting, but you don't have to do it alone. Contact a certified counselor at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling at 1-800-388-2227, who can guide you every step of the way. This has been a public service message from the NFCC.
You're ready to take the next step in your education. Just starting college, you're ready to finish your degree, bachelor's, master's, or doctorate, traditional on campus or online. The right Christian college or seminary and the ideal degree program awaits you at ChristianCollegesNow.com. Find the perfect college or seminary with advanced search tools. When you're ready, we'll help you apply online. ChristianCollegesNow.com has everything you need to make your decision, from tips and advice to advanced planning, even online application. You'll find the degree you've been looking for at ChristianCollegesNow.com.
In this age of diversity and political correctness, you're told that you shouldn't criticize the beliefs of some groups, no matter what. So where does that leave Christianity? Should you stay silent about people's beliefs about salvation when they don't square with Scripture? John MacArthur addresses those questions as he continues the study, Delivered by God, this week on Grace to You.
So join me, John MacArthur, and study along on Grace to You weekday mornings at 8 here on WLQV.
Information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Here again is Paul Edwards on Faith Talk 1500.
Pete Wehner, as I pointed out yesterday, has an interesting, for lack of a better characterization, op-ed on James Dobson leaving Focus on the Family. He's officially retired from there, as you know. Be done there in February, but then in March he's beginning a new radio venture with his son, Ryan. And Wehner points out in his piece yesterday at the American Enterprise Institute's blog, in announcing his new venture on his Facebook page, Dr. Dobson wrote, quote, "Our nation is facing a crisis that threatens its very existence. We are in a moral decline of shocking dimensions," end quote. And then Pete Wehner picks up from there to go on to challenge Dr. Dobson and to suggest. And, of course, Pete Wehner, writing from a conservative perspective and even a social religious perspective. He's on our side, Pete Wehner is. He's on Dr. Dobson's side. But Wehner argues, look, the reality is the number of abortions performed annually in the United States has dropped to a level not seen since the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade. The divorce rate is now at its lowest level in decades. Since the high water mark of 94, the national welfare caseload has declined by around 60%. Teen drug use has declined significantly since the 90s. So has the birth rate for teenagers between ages 15 and 19. The number of high school students who have reported ever having sexual intercourse has dropped as well. Teen use of alcohol and binge drinking has also fallen sharply. The murder rate has dropped. And it should be lower still in 2009, according to new figures released by the FBI. And Wehner is arguing, look, Dobson seems to be painting this bleak, negative, dark picture, when in reality, Focus on the Family, the American Family Institute, and all of these pro-family groups have actually made great progress. Why then would James Dobson come out and say we're in a moral decline of shocking dimensions? And I'm arguing that maybe for the same reason the civil rights people have to keep racism alive in this country to stay in business. Maybe we on the pro-family side have got to keep bad things happening in the culture in order to stay in business. Say it ain't so. We'll be back again tomorrow at 4.
Yo, where'd everybody go?
Are you tired of paying $100 an hour for computer support just for the prompt to return? Hi, I'm Luke Ford, founder and CEO of My Computer Works. Whenever you have a major computer catastrophe or a simple question, give my U.S.-based computer technicians a call, and they'll remotely connect your computer and fix the problem for you. It's safe, secure, and you won't have to let a stranger into your home. Call now to receive 1 month of service free with a membership. Now let's hear from some of our satisfied customers.
They cleaned up the computer and I sat there and watched everything going on. I was just having a ball.
So the convenience of having My Computer Works connect to my computer right then, fix it for me immediately, is priceless.
I was having a lot of major problems with my computer, and they basically evaluated the computer and went through and eliminated the problems I was having.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849. Mike.